Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
My guest, national best-selling author Daniel Stone, is a former staff writer for National Geographic and a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He is a native of Los Angeles and has degrees from UC Davis and Johns Hopkins University. For his book, Sinkable, Daniel Stone spent years interviewing marine biologists and astrophysicists, shipwreck experts, historians, and many more, to tell the story of the Titanic and the people who devote their lives to tracking lost ships and lost treasure. The full title of his book is Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Daniel Stone, welcome.
Thanks, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
I think your book is timely because just since the beginning of 2022, at least three major wrecks have been found. And there was one that sank over 100 years ago. And that one I'm thinking of is Ernest Shackleton's ship. Would you like to tell us about that ship that was found?
Yeah, we're in kind of a gold rush era at the moment of shipwreck discovery, largely as a result of advances in new technology that lets us see deeper. Ernest Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, was lost more than 100 years ago under about 2 miles thick Antarctic ice. And so a lot of people, me included, thought this ship would never be found. But using drones and underwater autonomous vehicles, researchers were able to locate it and continue their search for other culturally interesting, scientifically important, and of course, treasure-filled wrecks all over the world.
Well, when I come across things that are interesting in your book, I go to Google and I learn more about these various things. And one of the things that piqued my interest right now is that there was a shipwreck discovered from like the 7th or 8th centuries, the best they can tell. And this was near Bordeaux in France. And I happened to be just a few miles from there. So I was really interested in this shipwreck. Now, your book is about the deep sea. And this was not deep, but it was, I found a fascinating discovery. Have you done any research on this new discovery?
I don't know about that one wreck in France, but I do know that there are many of these, often turned up, sometimes what feels like every day. And the reason is a kind of vast underestimation we have about shipwrecks. Most people that I ask, you know, if you had to name a number of how many wrecks there are in the world, most people, perhaps you and me, could together come up with maybe a couple dozen that we could name by name. But the number is much bigger when you think of all of the various eras of seafaring, of lake ferries, of merchant ships across oceans, lakes, rivers. UNESCO puts the estimate at number of wrecks at 3 million wrecks all over the world. Vastly more than I would have thought ever when I started this. They're everywhere. They're in places where you'd imagine, you know, in deep ocean. They're especially around major seafaring countries historically, like England and parts of Europe, east coast of the United States. But they're also, like you said, in places you would never expect, like in the Bordeaux region of France, there are ships. There are wrecks in cornfields in Kansas, you know, from old riverboats, riverboating eras. There are wrecks in the deserts of Namibia, where there used to be ocean and there's not anymore. There was even a wreck found under the rubble of the Twin Towers after they were excavated and salvaged after 9/11. So there are wrecks kind of used as fill in every major port city in the world to expand the city. And when archaeologists go look, often they find.
My guest is Daniel Stone, and he has written a book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. And Dan, you were just telling us how many shipwrecks there are. That's pretty astounding. And when you consider, for example, the shipwreck in Bordeaux, the estimate was 1,300 years ago. So shipwrecks, we've been as human beings, have been on ships for thousands of years. And yet we would suppose that more people have died, say, in car accidents than in ships because we just are unfamiliar with what you've just been telling us. And cars are pretty recent on the scene for transportation. So researchers probably think more people have died on boats than ever will in car accidents.
That's true. And that's kind of a conservative estimate of death comparison. But I'll give you an example. I mean, there are vast eras of seafaring in our past, right? Going back to the Greek eras, the Roman Empire, of course, the eras of exploration of European empires that sent ships and explorers to the New World, right? And to all their colonies. There are, you know, a lot of famous people from those eras, but vastly more people who are completely forgotten. Probably the best example of this is the slave era, right? There were millions, tens of millions of enslaved people that were basically sent from West Africa to be slaves in Europe and in North America. Many of those people were brought over by ship, all of them, and a lot of them didn't make it. As many as 1 in 6 slaves who were sent on these overpacked slave ships died at sea, and their ships went down and were lost at sea. There is very little archaeological record of this era because a lot of it wasn't written down, but only recently have archaeologists tried to piece together that era. And that era is one of many eras that we don't know much about. So yes, many, many millions of people have died at sea and in wrecks, many more than have died since the advent of cars and planes, which is pretty new.
Well, so the implication is that there are a lot of wrecks that are still not found that we would like to know about. For example, we'd like to know, what about those 3 ships that Columbus came to the New World in? Do we have wrecks of his ships?
Well, there's the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria. The Nina and Pinta were found and discovered. They actually made it back to, you know, their home port. The Santa Maria has been missing since 1492. Many people have looked for it and not been able to find it. So it is one of these great wrecks of the world that's still missing. There are a few others. One is called the SS Warata. That's often labeled Australia's Titanic, very similar story to the Titanic, but Australian in origin. That's also never been found. The Endeavour from Captain James Cook in the South Pacific, also never quite found. The biggest shipwreck hunters are really the ones who go after the buried treasure. And there have been Spanish galleons and other kind of colonial ships found laden with tons of gold, literal tons, hundreds of millions of dollars. But the most valuable shipwreck ever to sail and fail is a ship called the Flor de la Mar. It was a Portuguese ship that sank in 1511 near the coast of Sumatra in Indonesia. And it has never been found, but it was so loaded with gold that that is believed to be the reason why it sank. And the gold today is valued at about $2 billion, as much as $2 billion. So it is still out there. Many people have looked, and someone will eventually find it who does their research and has the right equipment.
Well, I thought about this question of how much gold existed in the New World, because when I lived in Peru, there's an entire museum devoted just to gold in that country. And I'm thinking, gosh, if they had that much just to put in the museum, and individuals had their own collection of gold, then how much did they attempt to send back to, say, Spain or whatever country they came from? And even today, I know people who like to scuba dive or look for gold or silver or even diamonds in shipwrecks.
Yeah, gold, silver, diamonds, teak wood, and indigo were kind of the most valuable commodities that were sent to and from colonies. To the question of how much, we don't really know, because, you know, records of that era were kept, but also this is many hundreds of years ago. We do know Spain was the main center of this colonial power in the eras when gold mining became possible, and gold shipping was the common way to send gold basically from colonies back to the home base, the colonial home base in Spain. This is why Spanish galleons especially are famous for being laden with gold and especially popular for treasure hunters. There are also parts of the ocean that are especially fertile for finding these wrecks. You could follow the trade routes from basically South America, the North Coast around Colombia or Venezuela, back to Spain through the Caribbean, around the coast of Florida, and over east to Spain. And along that stretch, especially in the kind of rocky waters off East Florida and North Carolina, are notorious, famous for being kind of the galleon graveyard. This resulted in a literal gold rush of people trying to find these ships and their treasure that really peaked in the 1970s, but is still ongoing today.
But it's not very easy to find these wrecks. Why is it so hard?
Well, wrecks that are shallow are fairly easy to dive to send, you know, divers down to. But most of the treasure in shallow wrecks has been long ago found. The challenge really is with deeper wrecks, and ships that sink in open ocean can be a mile or 2 miles deep. The Titanic itself is 2.5 miles deep. This mainly is the domain of professional salvage companies and professional treasure hunters, who basically get a enormous number of investors and millions of dollars to help fund a search, to rent and pay for the expensive equipment and the time of, you know, advanced professionals in physics and deep sea engineering. And they go with a pretty good idea of where the wrecks are based on their research that they've done in advance. The deepest wreck ever found was one about 10 years ago called the SS City of Cairo, about 3.5 miles deep in the South Atlantic. This wreck, to find anything 3 miles deep in enormous pressure, cold water, and, you know, punishing darkness, it's pitch black down there, is not for the faint of heart. It's not for someone who has a sailboat and wants to go treasure hunting. It's for, you know, you think of kind of the most advanced equipment and the most well-funded searchers on Earth, and it's them.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, a donor gave $10 million to find Ernest Shackleton's ship, Endurance.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because Shackleton's ship was not carrying, you know, tons of valuable stuff like gold or silver or diamonds. But it is a culturally important and interesting wreck. It's one of the great stories of survival and literal endurance of its crew that managed to survive.
That's shocking how long they were able. And it wasn't like they were in a garden spot where the food was available. That's pretty astounding that they survived that.
Yeah, it's one of the great stories, similar to the Titanic. It's one of the great stories of the 20th century that people can't get enough of. So to find the wreck is compelling and important in its own right, even if you're not going to turn up gold or silver. I will say that there are other ways to value a wreck like the Endurance. That wreck will soon be the subject of films and documentaries. The search itself will be told in great detail. We will likely see books and maybe museum exhibits and other ways that story can be told, and to make the search valuable and worthwhile for the people who found it, a way to monetize it as well.
My guest is national bestselling author Daniel Stone, whose book is Sinkable. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, best-selling author Daniel Stone, who has written a book about shipwrecks. And the title of his book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. And I was somewhat amused that you entitled your book Sinkable, because a lot of titles, unsinkable person or thing, but you're honoring what was sinkable.
Yeah.
And the word obsession is in the title. Now, is that you, Dan? Are you obsessed?
Well, sinkable and obsession are both kind of interesting elements to the story of all wrecks. The one being that every ship that has ever sailed and ever will is sinkable, and almost all of them eventually sink, or that, you know, they reach the end of their working life and they're pulled apart for scraps, or they're just sunk in open water and scuttled, you know, sunk on purpose. Obsession, though, really speaks to this underworld of people that is far larger than you'd think, of people who devote their lives to sunken ships, to the mystery behind them, the details and the storytelling that encompasses, you know, just great tales of valor and cowardice and drama, right? And then I found kind of an even more obsessed group of people. I have three main characters in the book who all devoted their lives to the Titanic, and not just the story of it, but finding it throughout the 20th century and salvaging it. They wanted to pull it out of the water and give it kind of a place in a museum on a pedestal.
And you just told us it was 2.5 miles deep in the ocean, the Titanic was.
Yeah, almost unreachable for a long time. I mean, the Titanic was lost for more than 70 years. Nobody knew where it was. And the reason why is exactly that. It was really deep, and we didn't have the technology to go find it, look that deep. It was enormously laborious to trawl the seafloor with sonar to find it. And so it's really not until the 1980s when we have the technology that is advanced far enough, we have the appetite to go find it. And a young Navy officer named Bob Ballard is the one who had kind of the right resume and the luck of having the right equipment to be the one who found it.
I can just imagine the excitement of spending so much time and energy looking for a ship, and then when you find it.
I write in the book that shipwreck hunters are an abundant species, but shipwreck finders are a much more elite club of people who go out and find them. I spoke with one for the book named David Mearns, and Mearns is kind of a classic discoverer. You know, he has a resume of you know, a dozen wrecks that he's found, and he's often given, you know, money and trust by rich investors to go find them because of his track record. But he told me that, you know, the hardest part is not the search. It's not the underwater part, which of course is hard and expensive. It's the research, the first phase that frankly anybody could do from their house, right? It's online research, archival research, going through newspapers and books, trying to find eyewitness accounts of how a ship was built, how it sailed, how it wrecked, what happened in the moments after. And it's usually in those details, he said, that you find, you know, one tiny piece of information that kind of blows open a new way to look at a wreck, or a new maybe search area that narrows the search. And eventually, when you take your boat out, you have a lot more chance of success.
Well, I think if I were one of those lucky people who found a shipwreck, I don't know that I'd be that eager to tell people, because is it possible to steal a shipwreck?
Less so than it used to be. Shipwrecks are kind of exist in this hazy legal zone where they could be, you know, built in one country, they could sail to another country carrying the cargo of, you know, many other countries and the citizens of others. So when they sink in deep water, depending on how valuable the material is they were carrying, you know, they could be subject to these international court battles, which has happened with, you know, big ones like the Titanic. But stealing wrecks doesn't often happen. There was a culture around Florida, as I mentioned, those Spanish galleons in the 1970s, where people would find treasure chests, almost literal treasure chests of gold coins, and not tell anyone or try to keep it a secret. Today, it's very difficult to keep them secrets for those legal reasons I mentioned. But there is kind of a weird quirk I found, especially in the Indian Ocean, that wrecks that went down, especially World War II wrecks, are newly being dismantled by divers from more developing, poorer countries that find value in the steel. So they'll send divers down to take apart a wreck that could be the size of a football field, enormous ships, and they'll dismantle it rivet by rivet. And back on shore, they'll melt the steel down and sell it by the ton.
Well, you mentioned that these ships now we are finding more because of our technology, but I find it so fascinating, these really old wrecks. Well, just this one in near Bordeaux from, say, the seventh century, but there are so many more older ones. And we can learn, they're studying this because they want to learn about the ship and whatever they can learn there. So when people find these really old wrecks, what does the condition tell us about the underwater environment?
Well, environment is everything, and the environment is different everywhere on Earth. I mean, the two most corrosive forces on planet Earth are sunlight and salt water. So any wreck that sinks in shallow water, you know, less than a couple hundred feet, is instantly subject to sunlight and salt water. They break down very quickly. The better preserved wrecks, and the ones that scientists really get fascinated about, are the ones in deep water, and especially in low salinity environments. And that helps preserve the wrecks. There is no more kind of prized environment on Earth for preserving wrecks than the Black Sea, right? This major inland lake between Eastern Europe and Central Asia. The Black Sea is very deep. It's about a mile deep, and it has very low salinity. So the salt doesn't really break down these ships. And in the Black Sea, scientists have found ships from old Greek and Roman era travelers, you know, some as old as, you know, 2,000 to 4,000 years. These are wooden ships, and wood, of course, you know, breaks down very quickly when it's in the presence of sunlight. But when it can be preserved that deep, some of the exact hand carvings in wood that were made 4,000 years ago are still there. These ships are kept in very, very good shape and allow this portrait of these time capsules of an era that you know, is very distant from us.
Well, I happen to have had an opportunity years ago to see Viking ships preserved in a museum, and they had to keep spraying them with water in the museum.
Yeah, I mean, there are museums with wrecks that have to constantly preserve their wrecks. There is one ship in Bristol called the Great Eastern that is, you know, was basically housed in a humidifier to keep it as dry as possible, almost like desert conditions to keep it preserved. That's true also with the Vasa, one of the most famous preserved wrecks on Earth in Sweden. That is Sweden's most popular tourist attraction, the Vasa. So if you can salvage a wreck and instantly stop its breakdown, you can keep it in shape for a long time.
My guest is Daniel Stone, and he has written a book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. And you tell us fascinating facts about shipwrecks. For example, what is the worst place on Earth to be shipwrecked? I mean, I would think that Ernest Shackleton's ship, that would be a pretty bad place to be shipwrecked.
Well, yes, to be shipwrecked anywhere near Antarctica is generally not enviable. But there is a worst place on Earth, definitive, agreed upon by shipping captains, to be wrecked. And it's a point called Point Nemo in the South Pacific, a little atoll. Point Nemo is the furthest point in the ocean from any major landmass. It's between New Zealand and Chile. That's before you have kind of polar temperatures and very, very rocky seas. Also, Point Nemo is the unofficial dumping ground for satellites that fall out of the sky. When satellites meet the end of their working life, the agencies that run them guide them toward Point Nemo for the lowest chance of you know, hurting anybody. So shipping captains agree that Point Nemo is a place to be avoided.
Well, I remember heard about Moby Dick, for example, and first heard the story of how that novel was inspired by reality. So what about what inspired Moby Dick?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a ship called the Essex, which sank in the mid-19th century in about 1850, around there. And it was, you know, kind of this wild story of survival where a lot of its, you know, the wreck was, or the ship was hit by a whale, a sperm whale, and the survivors made their way to an island where they ended up surviving and becoming essentially cannibals to survive. And it's, you know, this kind of harrowing wreck story of history that was pretty famous in its day, almost like what the Titanic is today. It inspired these kind of horrific reactions from the general public and this Victorian sensibility of how driven mad the people must have been. It also inspired a writer named Herman Melville to write a fictional account of it. And he wrote it, I believe, in the late 19th century. It didn't become a famous classic for, I think, 20 or 30 more years. But that wreck itself kind of inspired one of the great classic novels of all time. And that speaks to the long shelf life that some of these wrecks have, that they're discovered and rediscovered by new generations, none more than the Titanic, which, you know, was one wreck among millions of others on Earth. It had some famous and rich people. It sank when it was considered unsinkable, but it has been reinterpreted and reinvented all throughout the 20th century in films every few decades and in, you know, untold number of books and documentaries and museum exhibits. There's musical theater that's been written about the Titanic. There is no shortage of artistic interpretations of the Titanic. And the same was true for the Essex that inspired Moby Dick.
Well, the Titanic is in the title of your book, The Shipwreck of the Titanic. And what did you find fascinating about that, Dan?
Well, I wondered several times throughout writing the book why this one wreck really kind of vaulted into global international stardom, right? How did it get to the top? And there's very little about the Titanic that's really unique, as I mentioned, right? Ships had been built bigger and bigger for many decades. They had been considered unsinkable since the advent of steel hulls. They were hitting icebergs so much throughout the 19th century that by the 20th century, iceberg strikes had started to decline. And so there's only one factor about the Titanic that's really different, and it's the survival account, right? 1,500 people died, but about 700 people lived. And those 700 people were mostly young women and children who lived another 50 to 60 years telling and retelling the stories of that night. And that storytelling was really it. That was enough to keep the story alive long enough for major advances in storytelling, right? The innovation of film, color film, talking film, wide distribution of books and music that got this story kind of renewed relevance several times throughout the 20th century. It's a remarkable story of survival, but also of storytelling.
My guest is former staff writer for National Geographic and national bestselling author, Daniel Stone. And he's devoted for years, spent years researching his subject for this book. The title is Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Dan, I've done a little bit of scuba diving, but always in clear blue water and not very deep. But I'm sure there are a lot of divers that would want to go deeper. And where would you recommend that they go if they're a diver and they want to find a shipwreck?
If they're in the U.S., there's really no better place than off the coast of Florida, even close to the coast. I mean, you could get diving tours that will take you to old wrecks just to see old ships and swim through them and, you know, see what remains of them. Some of the best preserved wrecks are in the South Pacific, you know, on the islands of Micronesia, Vanuatu. World War II wrecks especially. Some of those wrecks are very well preserved and some of the most popular wreck dives in the world for how much detail you can see. You know, you could still make out soldiers' beds and their uniforms and their books, the glasses they used and the plates. I mean, these are kind of relics of these old time capsules that are really evocative, especially when you see them up close.
I did know a guy when I lived in Florida who had a day job, but when he had time off, he would explore undersea off the coast of Florida. And I was kind of surprised at what he was able to find just as an amateur.
Yeah. I mean, Florida especially is a really fertile place to find all sorts of stuff, but particularly because in the 1970s and 80s, Florida officials got this kind of crazy idea that, you know, we have a lot of coral here, but we want to create more coral reefs. And so we need to sink anything we can. And so, you know, there was this culture of sinking old cars and bathtubs, water heaters, anything they could, you know, get underwater with the hope that coral would grow on it and attract new fish and spur new ecosystems. And this was all great fun and games until they kind of got out of hand and they started sinking thousands of car tires that they thought would just sink in these giant piles. But the tires were not heavy enough to sink. So they effectively just rolled around the ocean floor like tumbleweeds, killing existing coral and had to be remediated. Florida officials are still pulling old tires out of the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, you, in your research over quite a period of time, years of research, what was your best source of information for your book, Dan?
Mostly people who inhabit this world, who are willing to talk to me about the work that they do. I talk to a lot of undersea divers, people who go really deep, far deeper than you or I, you know, casual divers would ever go. I talk to treasure hunters who, you know, explain to me kind of the process of how they do what they do. And also, you know, they don't really have time to talk with people like me. They're impatient people. I think that's what drives them. Also, I talked with a lot of scientists, and I talked with the main character of my book, Doug Woolley, this kind of deeply obsessed man throughout the 60s and 70s, who really became embodied with the Titanic. It became his identity, his obsession, and his sense of ownership over the wreck, sometimes literally, and that he wanted to find it and salvage it. I thought Doug Woolley had long ago passed away, but I actually found him still alive. He's now 86, and I went to visit him in London to hear his story of his deep obsession. So the best stories are really found from people. They're in people's minds and waiting to be told if you ask for them.
Well, with these new discoveries happening just this year, are you planning to write an updated version of your book, Dan?
I might update the foreword or the author's note, depending on what new ones are found. I will say, fortunately, I had written in the book that I didn't think the Endurance, Ernest Shackleton's ship, would ever be found on account of just how remote it was and that people had been looking for over a century. But by the grace of God, the ship was found about 4 days before my book went to press. And so I was able to wipe the egg off my face and rewrite that section. And I think it's true. There will be many more shipwrecks found, and I think we'll constantly be upturning relics from history. It's kind of part of our culture and our history.
Well, I wouldn't expect this medieval shipwreck that was found in France to be in your book. One, it was so very recent. It was not deep sea, as your title implies. But I found that my French archaeologist friend referred me to a woman, an archaeologist who was working on site, and she was so enthusiastic about the subject and sent me all sorts of links that I followed and thought, wow, this is all so interesting. So I can imagine how you could spend quite a few years researching this, Dan.
Yeah, there's no end to it too. I mean, these are relics that really touch all of us in going around talking about this book. What I found is everyone has a wreck that's really meaningful to them or that they remember from their childhood. There are wrecks in kind of every body of water on Earth. And if you live near one, you learn the stories of them and you hear from the archaeologists who study them. And so we all have a closer tie to the ocean and the ocean's history, I think, than we often think.
Well, thank you for writing this book, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy, for having me.
My guest has been Daniel Stone, and the title of his book is Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. After a break, I'll come back with local author and former competitive runner, Walt Schaefer. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest, retired sociology professor Walt Schaefer, has written several books on stress management and wellness. With his emphasis on community health, he serves as a member of the Board of Trustees of Enloe Medical Center. He is a past president of Chico Rotary Club and current president of the Honey Run Covered Bridge Association. Walt Schaefer had been a competitive runner in high school. In the summer of 1975, Professor Schaefer helped co-found the Chico Running Club. He went on to serve as founding race director of the Bidwell Classic and Almond Bowl Run road races. In his early 60s, he switched to cycling, and on his 83rd birthday, he and his wife rode 83 miles. Walt Schaefer, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Privileged to be here.
Well, you are have played such a role in helping people deal with stress here in the community that I'd like you to tell us about the Enloe Stress and Health Center.
Well, thank you. And first, let me thank you for your kind comments about me on your interview with David Broom. In 1979, I had been teaching a course called Human Stress at Chico State, and I had a kind of a dream about a community center. And I went to Enloe Hospital. They bought my salary for a year and a half to found the Enloe Stress and Health Center and also the Cardiac Rehabilitation Program. The Stress and Health Center was aimed at providing education about stress and stress management to the community and the area. I did workshops and classes and individual consultations. The main class I taught for 10 years was called Reducing Perfectionism, Irritability, and Hurry Sickness. And that reached about 1,200 people over a decade, every other week, hour and a half class, 10 sessions. And then in the mid-80s, we hired several therapists and had five full-time marriage family therapists for several years. I moved back to university full-time in 1981 and did these classes on the side and directed the center. So it was a great program. It lasted until the mid-90s, directed by, after I moved on and after a few years, directed by Terrence Hoffman, who directed it till the early 2000s. So I have great memories. I still see people who took those classes, and they still remember some of the tips and advice and things that we worked on.
My guest is Walt Schaefer, and he is, I'm going to call you an expert on stress reduction, Professor Schaefer. And you have played a role in making people aware of how important it is to do something about stress. So if today somebody wanted to contact Enloe Hospital about reducing stress, what would you recommend that they do?
Well, they can go to the Enloe website, enloe.org, and there are several links there to sites with advice on meditation techniques, on exercise, social support, connecting with resources in the community. That would be my main advice at this point. My own books are still available, by the way, on Amazon.com. The fourth edition of my book, Stress Management for Wellness, was published in 2000, but that's still available, and earlier editions are available. And in my first book in 1978, called Stress, Distress, and Growth, is still available on Amazon.com, and it sells for about $2.50.
Well, you mentioned Enlow Cardiac Rehabilitation Program, and did you have a role in that?
I did. During that year and a half when I was full-time at Enlow Hospital, I co-founded the cardiac rehab program with Dr. Fred Evans, cardiologist, the only cardiologist in Chico at that time. So I wrote the plan, and I was the first director for administrative director. He was the medical director for the first year. And that was a great honor. I continued to present stress management classes for another decade and a half to cardiac rehab patients. And I had my students at Chico State attend the exercise classes, which were walking classes on the track and in the gym at Chico State for many, many years until COVID just started. And I had my students walk with patients and visit with them and then write a little paper about what they learned. So it was good for both the patients and the students. And the cardiac rehab program is still going on. It's now entirely indoors, but it's a very vital part of recovery from heart attacks, bypass surgery, as well as prevention.
So you still play a role because you are a member of the Board of Trustees of Enlow Medical Center, and I'm sure you must continue to promote stress reduction in that role, do you?
I do. We have developed a 5-year strategic plan for Enlow Hospital and community health, and dealing with stress is one part of that. I didn't go into details about our report, but Enlow Hospital is now implementing that plan that we developed in 2020 with a community health committee, and I'm very proud of the work that Enlow Hospital is doing in this regard.
Well, when you were in high school, you were a competitive runner, and then and you continued running until your early 60s, and then you switched to cycling. And do you encourage people to do that?
Well, first of all, I let me just go back to the beginning. I was one of seven kids in a family, kind of a nobody in the family, and I discovered I could run. And beginning my freshman year, I began competing on the track, ended up a high school state champion, and then went to University of Michigan on a full track scholarship and had a great career. Running was a very important part of my childhood and youth, and I loved running. I continued competing into my early 60s in running, I think running is a tremendous way of one part of dealing with stress, and I then switched to cycling. My wife is a triathlete and an avid cyclist, and I kind of moved to cycling with her, and so I get some of the same rewards from cycling that I did as a runner, whether it's running, walking, cycling, swimming. One of my tips for healthy aging is to keep moving, and I've been able to keep doing that, and I intend to as long as I can.
Well, you made the switch to cycling, and you said your wife also joined you doing that. And you recently went cycling in Scotland with your wife, Teresa.
Yes, I did. We just got back 2 weeks ago. It was a great, we were there 16 days, including a week of a cycling tour of the Isle of Mull, M-U-L-L. The tour was put on by a touring company that we had used in Nova Scotia. They're located in Nova Scotia, but they had a tour that's offered to the public The only ones who signed up were myself, my wife, Teresa, my daughter, Kristen, my son-in-law, Jim, and my grandson, Connor. So it was five of us on a week-long tour. And we had a great time. It was just a very fun vacation. And we saw some beautiful country in Scotland. It was very green, very good weather. Rain was forecast, but it was drizzly the first morning. After that, it was beautiful weather. So it was a very nice trip.
Well, I'd like to go back to when you were still running, because in the 70s, I did some running. I was not a competitive runner, but I would go out regularly and I would run for an hour. The distance was sometimes greater or less because I would just run for an hour. And during that time, the name Frank Shorter was a big name in running. And I even think I owned a pair, or my husband did, a pair of those striped shorts, red and white or blue and white striped shorts. So for people who don't remember, who was Frank Shorter?
Well, Frank Shorter was a collegiate runner at Yale University and who went on to win the Olympic marathon in Munich in 1972. And he held the American record at that time. He then took a silver in Montreal in 1976. And he was a kind of a leading advocate for running in this country worldwide, very very well known and a real inspiration. He also was an attorney, but he was a full-time runner at that time. And you know, when we did the Bidwell Classic, I was a race director from the mid-70s until the mid-80s, and he lived in Denver at that time, and occurred to me, well, why don't we see if Frank Shorter would come to Chico and run our half marathon or our marathon? So I mailed him a letter and heard back. And he said, you know, I had hoped that I could come. I was going to be in on the West Coast right at that time, but I had another obligation. I was not able to come, but I sure wish I could have been there. So that was my one contact with Frank Shorter. It would have been great if he'd been here, but we came close.
My guest is retired sociology professor Walt Schaefer, and he is committed to emphasizing community health and has begun the Chico. He co-founded the Chico Running Club, for example, and served as race director for some of these road races. And you encourage all ages to run. And I remember talking to former president of Chico State, Emmanuel Esteban, and he gives you a lot of credit. What did you do that you would gain a fan of President Esteban?
Well, I met him soon after he arrived in late summer of 1993. Kathy Kaiser was a former runner at that time. My colleague at Chico State introduced me to him at a social gathering, and I had heard that he was a runner. So I said, I understand you're a runner. He said, yeah, I ran at Humboldt University when I was vice president there. And I said, well, how about if we take a run together? And he said, okay, call my secretary. So I called his secretary, and she scheduled a run for a few days later. And we then and we became very good friends and running partners. I ran with him almost every day for the 10 years he was president. And at the beginning of the semester, we would schedule the run sometime midday into his schedule. And I'd meet him at the locker room. We'd run for, 45 minutes, whatever. And I kind of became his priest, as he described me. I did a lot of listening and encouraging. His first couple of years were very challenging, and I think I was important to him. And our runs were where most of those conversations occurred. We're still friends.
Well, if the average person listening is saying, you know, maybe I should take up running, but I don't know if it's fun. Is there such a thing as a Saturday fun run that people could participate in?
Yes, there are. Chico Running Club, we formed Chico Running Club in summer of 1975. It's still going on. And one of the first, and all, even before we formed the club, there had been Saturday morning fun runs at Hooker Oak. And they later moved down to 1 mile. So Chico Running Club still exists. The Chico Running Club still sponsors the Almond Bowl Run, the Bidwell Classic half marathon, 5K. And every Saturday morning at 1 mile on the north side, there by the entrance to the parking lot, Chico Running Club at 8 o'clock in the morning, people just gather there and run in the park, run anywhere from a mile to 6 mile loop of Lower Park. And so it's still been going on here for what, 47 years at least.
Well, you, yeah.
And that's a good way, if I could just add, it's a good way of meeting other runners, runners of all abilities. Some are going to be fast runners, competitive runners, but most are going to be joggers who do it for health and fellowship.
Yes. And I had been a competitive tennis player when I was growing up and through college. And when I took up running, I would come home and when I visit my parents and my dad would say, well, did you win? And I thought, well, I wasn't the first one to cross the finish line, but yeah, I was a winner. So I think if people would just come to your fun run or come out to run for fun on a Saturday, they could consider themselves winners.
Yes, I agree. And ChicoRunningClub.org has a very good website about the fun runs and other running events in the Chico area. I just looked at it again this morning. It's a very good website. Fleet Feet Store, by the way, has a good information as well. And I might just add that, you know, everybody knows Fleet Feet, downtown Chico. Fleet Feet was the second Fleet Feet of the chain of Fleet Feet stores. And now I think they have 100 and some stores around the country. And it started in Sacramento. Sally Edwards founded it. She was an avid runner. And she moved to Chico in 1978 to start the store, part of our community here. And Fleet Feet store has been in existence since then. So it was one of the pioneering stores and a very important center of running supplies and information in Chico.
Well, on behalf of our community, Walt, I would like to thank you for the role that you continue to play in our community health. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Nancy. I appreciate it.
And I would also like to thank my first guest, national best-selling author Daniel Stone, author of Sinkable.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.